Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Frisch, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are halfway through our calendar this morning. Our next case is A22-1826. Takvin, is it Lee or Lie?
Lee.
Takvin Lee, respondent, sorry, versus Jody Harpstead, Minnesota Commissioner for Human Services, appellant. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for, well, you both have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. At the start of those arguments, please state your name, the party you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll keep an audio-only recording of this for posting on our public website. The podium goes up and down. There's a toggle switch, so adjust it when you take the podium to your needs. And we are ready for counsel for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brandon Basie. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the appellant, the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Immediately upon denying the commissioner's motion to dismiss, the district court, without receiving any evidence or hearing any evidence, issued a peremptory writ of mandamus against the commissioner that required her to, one, immediately admit Mr. Lee to a state-operated treatment program, and two, submit monthly reports on every person in the state of Minnesota to whom the 48-hour or the priority admission law applies. The district court's peremptory writ should be reversed for three general reasons. The first is that there was no clear and unmistakable duty on the commissioner to admit Mr. Lee within 48 hours of his commitment. Second, even if there was such a duty, the writ had deficiencies in it, specifically that it did not allege that there was adequate funding for the commissioner to do the relief that was sought in the writ. And third, the district court committed a number of procedural errors, most notably that after it denied the commissioner's motion to dismiss, it immediately entered an order deciding the final liability against the commissioner without providing her a chance to answer, go through discovery, or present any type of case in response to the allegations. Each one of those are reasons why this court can reverse the first two outright in the writ, the last one reverse and remand for further proceedings. I'll start, Your Honors, with the first point that I made, that the priority admission statute does not require the commissioner to admit Mr. Lee within 48 hours of his commitment.
What does that language mean then?
So the commissioner's interpretation of that, in which we think that this court should adopt, is within 48 hours of a medically appropriate bed being available.
Where's that in the statute?
Your Honor, it's not explicitly in the statute, and we fully admit that that language is not in the statute.
So then why should we interpret the statute to include language that doesn't exist?
Because the district court's interpretation, which is from order of commitment, also isn't in the statute.
Well, that's a different question. I mean, whether the district court's interpretation is correct doesn't necessarily mean that the interpretation that's being proffered by the commissioner is correct. So I think that what Judge Schmidt and I are asking you is, what is the basis of the commissioner's position that the statute should be interpreted in the way that the commissioner is suggesting when there's no language in the statute that would support that conclusion?
So, Your Honor, the commissioner's position is that the statute is ambiguous. So,
And what are the two reasonable or multiple reasonable readings of the statute based on its language?
So I think the language of the statute says that a person must be admitted within 48 hours, period. So that 48 hours could be 48 hours from commitment order. It could be 48 hours from notice of the commitment. The commissioner is not a party to civil commitment proceedings. So the only way the commissioner finds out about someone's commitment is if someone tells her. So it could be 48 hours from notice. It could be 48 hours from a medically appropriate bed. It could be 48 hours from
It be 48 hours from a medically appropriate bed? I mean, when I read the entirety of 253B as it was in its previous iteration before it was amended, it seems to me that the triggering event is the issuance of the commitment order for everything in the statute. There doesn't seem to be a triggering event identified in the statute tied to this current position by the commissioner, medically availability of medically appropriate beds.
Your Honor, I would disagree with the state. I guess I would. What I would say is I disagree that every event in Chapter 253 is triggered by commitment order. There are a number of things we identified in our brief. First of all, in 283B.10, the individual does not come under the commissioner's control until he or she is admitted. That's in 283B. There's other events in that statute that are triggered upon transfer of an individual or upon other events. And so I would disagree that every event is triggered off of the commitment order. I think there's a couple problems with. So the reason why you should accept the commissioner's interpretation, there's a few. So first of all, if any other interpretation results in the commissioner potentially violating the law without knowing she's violating the law. So if it's from a medically, or if it's from the time of commitment, well, I guess if it's from time of commitment, she could be violating without notice.
That seems like a defense to the statute, to the commissioner's obligation, as opposed to a construction of the statutory language.
So the
it's impossible for me to comply because I didn't know there was a commitment order that was issued.
So other reasons, Your Honor, is second, that the legislature knows how to include language in a statute if it wants to be triggered from a specific event. Here, the legislature. The original draft of this bill had language identifying from a commitment order. They took that out, and so this court shouldn't add language that the legislature specifically took out of the statute.
But the legislature also did not include any language about the availability of medically appropriate beds, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Third, Your Honor, I think what's very telling is that last year the legislature amended the statute to clarify when this ran from. And what it didn't do is it did not amend subdivision 1B. It did not change any of the language that existed at the time of Mr. Lee's commitment. All it did was add a single sentence in subdivision 1B that said persons that 1B apply to should be admitted within 48 hours of the medical director determining that a medically appropriate bed is available.
So I appreciate the position of the commissioner and the difficult position that she finds herself in attempting to satisfy the duty that's set forth in the statute. My question is whether we actually have to resolve the ambiguity at all, because I think that the threshold question is whether the petition states a claim for relief. And if we determine that perhaps the statute might be ambiguous because it doesn't identify precisely when from what the 48 hours, where that runs from, if it runs from either the issuance of the commitment order or the notice to the commissioner of the commitment order, one or the other, which could potentially be reasonable and render the statute ambiguous, why would we have to resolve that in order to say, yeah, there's a claim that has been stated here?
So the court doesn't have to resolve that issue now, but I think it should. And the reason it should is because, first, the plaintiff's entire writ is based on this statute. So without this statute, there is no writ. So if the court interprets the statute in the commissioner's, what the commissioner is advocating for, the writ is gone. And they're just there is no basis to say that the commissioner was violating a clearly established duty imposed by law. Second, even if the court decides to not resolve the ambiguity, and let's say the court agrees with us on the procedural defects below and remands for further proceedings, lets the commissioner answer, go through discovery, summary judgment, presumably we're still going to come back to this question about the statutory interpretation.
Well, why?
Issue.
The statute's been amended.
Because Mr. Lee is seeking damages in this case. And so
That's another interesting question, because if we did vacate the writ, the peremptory writ, then there is no peremptory writ. He already he's been placed in a bed. So if it's remanded to the district court, there's no relief that can be awarded in the form of a peremptory writ. and damages only flow following the issuance of a peremptory writ. So then what is there for the district court to even do upon a remand as you're requesting?
So I guess that's correct, Your Honor. I actually do agree with that. I think that that's consistent with this court's 14 Cherrywood decision that it recently issued last year. In that case, the relief that they sought in the writ and that was part of the alternative writ was completed before the peremptory was found, the court found the case moot, and the damages were not recoverable. So I do agree, Your Honor, under this court's precedent, that that's probably the result. So I think that the court still doesn't have to resolve the ambiguity because there are a number of other errors that were committed. So the other telling error in this case is that Supreme Court precedent is very clear in both the Powell and the Traeger decisions that we've cited that the lack of funding is a complete defense to a writ of mandamus, and it's not just a complete defense, it's a pleading requirement.
And let me ask you about that also. I mean, when I look at Rule 9.03 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and you're arguing in this case throughout that the Rules of Civil Procedure should apply to this proceeding, it seems to me that funding is a condition precedent, as you're arguing, to the commissioner's obligation to place an identified person under the priority admission statute. But Rule 9.03 provides that, and under Walsh versus U.S. Bank, that matters of, that are conditions precedent need not be pled with specificity, and they may be averred generally. So how do you reconcile our rules of civil procedure, which you're advocating apply, with the position that you're taking now?
Your Honor, so I agree that we believe the rules of civil procedure apply to the extent that they are not inconsistent with the statute. And so the weird thing about writs is that the initiating pleading is different than a civil action. So the initiating pleading is the alternative writ itself. The statute says, the pleadings allowed in writ cases are the writ, the answer, and a demur. And so there is no complaint. The petition is not really a pleading in a case. And so in writs, the pleading, the initiating pleading is the alternative writ. And what Supreme Court case law says is that that alternative writ, because of the extraordinary nature and rarity of writs, and because of the separation of powers issues that writs involve, that lack of funding needs to be appear on the face of the writ. And in the Powell case and the Traeger case, the court found that there was not, especially the Powell case, there was not funding that was pleaded in the, or that was identified in the alternative writ.
And why is that not superseded by our very well-established case law about notice pleading in the state of Minnesota and the specific rule of civil procedure that I previously referenced?
Your Honor, I think, you know, given the unique nature of writs, I'm not aware of any case law that has overruled Powell or Traeger. I'm not aware of any case law that has said that is a rule, that the notice pleading requirement in Minnesota applies to the initial writ in this case. What I do know is that both I believe that one of the two cases was a pre-civil procedure rule, but I think the other one who relied on it is a post-enactment of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure.
But not post-Walsh.
Correct, probably not post-Walsh.
What do you do if the petition and the alternative writ are conflicting documents or they contain conflicting information? Why shouldn't we consider both of them together and make fair inferences from those documents when considered together to determine whether the petition states a claim for mandamus relief?
Your Honor, well, in this case, the alternative writ makes no factual findings here. Mm-hmm.
Is that necessarily the fault of the petitioner?
I don't think it's the fault of the petitioner. I think it's the fault of the court. And so... The statute specifically says that the court can issue an alternative writ based on information, and it says that the facts for that alternative writ are supposed to be outlined in the alternative writ. It's not there. The problem in this case, Your Honor, is that even if you considered the petition and the facts alleged in the petition, and you inserted the facts alleged in the petition as the findings of fact for the district court, they're still deficient. They still don't outline funding for the commissioner. They don't outline funding that Mr. Lee is appropriate, or that the commissioner was able to do the thing he's asking. But even if that's true, even like if the court disagrees with us on statutory interpretation, if the court disagrees with us on funding, or at least on funding as far as like it has to be pled in the complaint, then that still leaves a fact question about whether what the funding issue is in the case, and that would require a remand, or at least that requires a finding that it should not have issued a peremptory writ at the point that it did. I'm not aware of any case law that has ever allowed a court to make final findings after denying a Rule 12 motion without allowing a party to present a defense.
Can you just help me clarify? I mean, there are, in my view, in my review of the record, a number of procedural anomalies that occurred in this case. And I just need you to help me understand what happened procedurally at the district court. I understand the case was assigned to one judge. That judge was removed. Another judge was assigned. The matter was set on for a review hearing. And then at that review hearing, the commissioner was ordered to argue its motion to dismiss. And is it correct that you were not notified in advance of the hearing that that motion was going to be heard that day?
Correct.
And were all of the supporting documents filed by that time?
No.
Okay.
At that point, so the commissioner was on notice that there was going to be a review hearing on November 17th. That was part of the alternative writ that was issued.
Yes.
After the district court was removed, the rules state that the hearing's canceled and then we await to have another hearing scheduled. So when this review hearing was set, no motion to dismiss had been filed at that point. The commissioner filed her motion to dismiss and then showed up at the hearing. I think opposing counsel had filed their response brief, but our reply hadn't been filed.
Thank you very much for helping.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Understand the record.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is James Conway. I represent Toke Von Lee. This case is about mandamus, which is a summary type of proceeding to compel government officials to protect the citizens of the state of Minnesota from overreach by those government officials. The government is not entitled to answer after the district court allows it the choice of a response, either to demur or answer, and then when the district court denies those legal defenses and denies the demur, a peremptory writ is appropriate.
What do we do in the circumstance here where there was no motion to dismiss that was actually filed and the commissioner was not on notice that there was going to be an argument held at the review hearing on the motion to dismiss and then forces the parties to argue the motion and issues the peremptory writ 2 days later? What do we do in that circumstance? It seems unfair to allow the commissioner, to deprive the commissioner of an opportunity to defend itself.
Judge Frisch, I think when Mr. Basie gave you the recitation of the factual proceedings in this case, that wasn't quite right. In the initial merits brief that was presented in this case before Lee went up to the Supreme Court, the commissioner acknowledged that the return of the writ hearing was rescheduled. So I think by using that language, the commissioner acknowledged they knew that that hearing was the hearing where the commissioner was coming in to show cause why they did not comply with the alternative writ.
But the notice that was issued by the court labeled that hearing as a review hearing, right?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay.
But I think everybody understood we were coming back on the return for the writ. So the purpose of that hearing under the mandamus statute and under the alternative writ would be to answer whether or not there had been compliance with the alternative writ, and if there wasn't compliance, why? So I think the concept that they don't know what's going to happen is not correct. And I think Judge Wilton was very clear at the hearing in the transcript that you have in speaking with Mr. Ikeda, the other assistant attorney general, everybody knows what's going on here. You filed your motion to dismiss in advance of that hearing. It's a 25-page brief. How are you not ready to argue that? Today is the hearing date. So I think that casting of the facts is just not right.
If there were a case in which, I mean, case law has permitted the respondent to one of these petitions to put in a motion to dismiss, essentially, right?
Yes.
And if there were a case where a respondent had both a legal defense as a matter of law, even accepting everything you say is true, you know, you lose, and also factual defense that I don't accept everything you say is in your allegations, and I have X, Y, and Z defense. Is it your argument that if the respondent chooses a motion to dismiss, that's it? They don't get to raise their factual disputes later in via an answer? And why would that be the case? Why would it depart so radically from regular civil litigation?
Yes, that is our position. To my knowledge, and we cited the case in our brief, there's only one case that I'm aware of where there was an election of doing an answer or a motion to dismiss, but what actually happened was they did both. They filed their answer and a motion to dismiss together. I think the proper method would be if you are challenging facts at any point in the procedure, you must answer. And just like someone might make an answer and include within the affirmative defenses, you fail to state a claim, and then later on they bring that motion after pleading the answer. I think that would be the proper methodology in a mandamus case.
So they should answer and raise legal as well as factual?
If they have factual challenges,
and
yes.
Is that consistent with the idea that case law has permitted a motion to dismiss? Are you saying case law doesn't?
I think
permit just a motion to dismiss in a regular course of civil litigation, which is that you have to accept for purposes of argument the truth, etc.
I don't think that mandamuses are a normal kind of case, and I think the statute and the history that we provided in our brief explain why. First of all, the district court can issue a peremptory writ on the petition alone and offer no opportunity to respond. The other dynamic is in this case, the district court was very clear. You may answer or you may demur.
Right, but I think you're saying if they have both legal and factual issues, they better only answer, right?
Correct.
You can't just bring a demur, which is a motion to dismiss in regular parlance, as we understand that to be, without losing any other defense.
That's correct, and I think the Jack case expressly says that. A Supreme Court decision from 1914 is on this exact point. It says if you demur and the demur is denied, the petitioner is entitled to a peremptory writ. The facts are admitted, and a peremptory writ shall issue.
Did that deal with a respondent's demur?
No, it did not.
No. So here we're talking about a respondent.
Oh, I'm sorry, a respondent. Yes, it did deal with the respondent's demur. The defendant's demur. Because there was only one other, there was the petition and one other pleading, and that was the demur.
Ask a question about your interpretation of 253b10.
Yes.
It seems in your briefing that the arguments are slightly different depending on where they are in the brief. It indicates at some points in time you indicate that the 48 hours begins to run upon the issuance of the commitment or order for commitment. And in some places, it seems to indicate that the 48 hours begins to run upon notification to the commissioner of the issuance of the notice of commitment. And those seem to be two different things. Is that right?
I don't think, well, if it reads that way, that wasn't our intention. Our belief is that the 48 hour begins to run upon the time of commitment.
And what does that mean?
So when the judge issues the order saying you are hereby committed to the Commissioner of Human Services, that's when the 48-hour clock starts to run.
And how is the commissioner supposed to know about the issuance of an order of commitment if nobody ever tells the commissioner about it?
Well, the statute says the district court shall inform the commissioner upon commitment.
Yes,
I think the reality,
we know that that's what is supposed to happen, but I mean mistakes do get made and there are possibilities that the commissioner is not notified.
The reality of the case, I think the reality of practice is that often the petitioning party, the Department of Human Services, the county commissioner of human services, typically notifies saying, hey, this person is in our jail, they were just committed, please come get them. That is exactly what happened in our case. On the same, immediately after the judge issued the order committing Mr. Lee, Heidi Schultz from the Scott County Human Services contacted the commissioner's office and said, we have Mr. Lee, come get him.
And I appreciate that factual context in this particular case, but isn't the possibility, or isn't the absence of specificity in the statute as to the triggering event that causes the 48 hours to run, and then these two possible interpretations, which I think are both reasonable, issuance of the order or perhaps notice to the commissioner of the issuance of the order, Doesn't that render the statute ambiguous?
I don't think so. I think, as Your Honor, Judge Fritsch indicated when you were speaking with Mr. Basie, if the commissioner didn't have notice, that's a really good defense if a district court issues an alternative writ. Because it says, hey, Mr. Lee was in our jail. You should have gotten him 63 days ago. If they come in and say, hey, the first time I learned about this is when I got served by the sheriff with this alternative writ, that sounds like a really good defense. But I think the reality of the situation is there's only one real reading, reasonable reading, of 253B10, and that is the time of commitment. If you look at 253B1A, it says when a patient is committed, and then it flows from there, what happens? The whole statute reads like that. It goes chronologically through the event. So the next thing to happen once you get to 253B is someone's getting committed. Mr. Basie's argument is that, well, there's actually some circumstances where people that are entitled to priority admission actually are not committed. But I think if the court reads even more closely into that, the Rule 20 situations where a court issues an order holding someone for evaluation, that is a warrant of commitment holding them pending evaluation. So while they haven't been committed in the 253B civil commitment process, there is still a court-ordered hold committing them to a particular facility for the purposes of a hold for evaluation for ongoing either Rule 20 proceedings in the criminal case or a commitment in this 253B process.
So I'm troubled by I'm troubled in attempting to reconcile the procedural aspect of this case with your statutory interpretation analysis. I mean, you've acknowledged that the commissioner would have a very good defense to its the discharge of its duty if it were not notified of its obligation to commit someone under the priority admission statute. But you're also, at the same time, arguing that the commissioner gives up its right to assert that very good defense if it believes in good faith that there's some legal defect with the statement of claim in the petition for mandamus and chooses to pursue immediate dismissal of that claim. Is that that's the effect of the position that you're taking as a whole? Am I correct?
I don't really think so. I think
then when would the commissioner have the if it moved to dismiss because there was some defect in the petition, when would it have the opportunity to assert the defense that it never was notified of the commitment order?
Well, I think they could present lack of notice as a legal defense. And I also think that upon receipt of the alternative writ, where it says either transfer this person to a treatment facility or come in here and show cause, if more than 48 hours go by from the time they get the alternative writ to the time they're returning to court to answer, I think at that point the 48 hours will have a, you know, they already were committed more than 48 hours ago, obviously. And now there's an additional 48 hours that have run. So even if the argument is there's a defense because really the statute runs at the time of notice, if more than 48 hours go by, there's really no defense there anyways.
I have a question. One of the things that we struggle with sometimes is if we remand this case to the district court, what do we tell them to do? Because this is a confusing and unusual situation in my view. Say we vacate the issuance of the peremptory writ for one reason or another. There's some procedural anomaly, some other reason. It's Lee, right, or Lai?
Lee.
Mr. Lee has received the relief that he sought initially under the mandamus petition, right? He has been placed in a bed. And so there's no further order that you would be seeking from the district court at that point in time. Is that correct?
You've seen the forest for the trees when you were questioning Mr. Basie. If this court vacates the peremptory writ, you kill Mr. Lee's case and his chance at damages under 14 Cherrywood. I think the clear intention of the district court in this case was to determine with some degree of finality the liability question. The issue of how...
I mean, at least in a mandamus proceeding. There might be other forms of relief that you could seek.
I don't know about that. I think that the district court had the intention of determining with finality the issue of liability. The case law that preceded this, which as we heard from the Supreme Court already in this case, is somewhat murky. There was a question about whether you could appeal it at all. These kinds of cases where damages hang over, is sort of the inversion of the 14 Cherrywood case. We have the peremptory writ right now, but the court held open the question of damages. It seems from 14 Cherrywood in our reading that you can issue a judgment for the purposes of and a peremptory writ together, that they're sort of a unified concept, and that damages flow out of that. Normally, in a civil case, when you get a money judgment, it says, defendant owes plaintiff $100,000. It seems in this world of mandamus, it may be that there's a judgment on the issue of liability, but damages flow in some kind of parallel or auxiliary proceeding to the underlying case. I think the district court said, look, judgments, I have to write how much they owe. We haven't had that damages aspect of this case yet, so there's not an ability for the court administrator to sort of file a judgment because I can't write the dollars in there yet.
But in this situation, doesn't the judgment have to be entered before the peremptory writ could even issue?
I think the peremptory writ I think it goes the other way around. If the court issues an order for a peremptory writ, judgment should issue at the same time. I think that's what 14 Cherrywood says. I think that's confusing, though, where the damages issues hang over. There's lots of mandamus cases where there's really not a damages component. It's a shareholder case. I just need the records of the corporation. There isn't a damages issue. Once I get the peremptory writ, you have to give me the stuff, and that's the end.
Can I just ask also, are you attempting to defend the district court's decision to require statewide reporting on cases that are outside of the one that was presented to it?
That was
a loaded question.
I would concede that the 253B does not contain some kind of reporting requirement. As we said in our brief, I think the court would have needed some mechanism to understand, is the commissioner complying with my peremptory writ? Which could be, you have to now swear under oath to me whether you complied with it or not. That's a reporting requirement.
So but I think not it, for other people.
Well, I think it could be legitimate for other people. If in this phase of the case, the court is ultimately going to determine damages, is this a systemic problem where the commissioner has abandoned every person like this in the state of Minnesota? Or is this targeted towards Mr. Lee? I think that's a relevant fact question for the court to understand. The final thing I wanted to indicate to the court is that this funding argument under, I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Wrap up.
This Traeger and Powell funding aspect, I think that's a wild goose chase for this court to understand. We pled in the petition that Mr. Lee wants to go into a set of hospitals that are run by the government, that are funded by appropriations, as are indicated in the appendix. Whether or not I think the argument is there's no allegation of funding at all. Traeger and Powell dealt with, we don't have standing public works departments that can clear your road or build your sewer. This is a case where the commissioner gets a $1 billion budget to do all its projects. It has specific funding for these hospitals, and we want to go into one of those hospitals that already exist. Thank you.
Thank you. And rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. None of the allegations regarding funding are in the petition or in the alternative writ. They were in documents provided alongside in their opposition to the motion to dismiss. You can't amend pleadings through motions or through briefs. Your Honor, I want to respond to a few of the things that counsel stated, some surprising things, honestly. I mean, we were at the Supreme Court for 15 months arguing about damages and liability and how they're wrapped up in one, and that the peremptory writ wasn't immediately appealable because there was still this outstanding issue of damages. And now, when we point out the fact that this court's 14 Cherrywood case comes out, that is exactly opposite of what counsel said. The court said that that the judgment must enter and the writ and damages flow from the judgment. Now they're saying the opposite. Now they're saying, oh, well, damages are ancillary, and so you should have issued judgment in the first place. That's not what the Supreme Court said at all. The Supreme Court accepted their argument that said they were together and they were one and that peremptory writs are not immediately appealable. In this particular case, we're going to exercise our inherent judgment for it, but in cases going forward, they're not immediately appealable if damages are outstanding. So I think it's pretty disingenuous to claim that damages are now ancillary when they were at the Supreme Court and won at the Supreme Court on that issue.
What is a judgment for that precedes a peremptory writ and damages? What would that judgment say?
I mean, the judgment I would assume would say that that a peremptory writ and damages should issue. My assumption is that a trial would have happened or summary judgment would have happened if there were no damages sought. The court decides liability in favor of the plaintiff and issues a judgment that says let a peremptory writ issue or let this amount of damages issue. That's what this court said in 14 Cherrywood, that the language is...
But the judgment precedes the determination of damages?
It precedes the award of damages.
Or the award, but not the determination thereof.
Correct. That's right.
Okay.
Right. This court said in 14 Cherrywood, the statute establishes that a successful plaintiff will receive a peremptory writ, damages, and costs and disbursements, but it requires that the plaintiff must obtain a judgment. Similarly, counsel was talking about defenses that the commissioner might raise if she didn't receive notice. That's a different argument that they were presenting to the district court and what the district court found. The district court was clear, plaintiffs were clear, there are no exceptions to the priority admission statute. And so it's not clear to me why they believe that lack of notice would be a defense today, but lack of funding isn't. Lack of funding, even if the court disagrees with our argument, which I think that it's clear from the Supreme Court precedent is clear that it has to be on the face of the writ, I don't think there's any reasonable way to read Traeger or Powell to say that funding is not a consideration and a defense to the commissioner, even if it's not a pleading deficiency. Your Honor, the other thing I'd like to mention is that there's this idea the counsel stated that we could file an answer and then move to dismiss. Well, the civil rules don't allow that. The civil rules require a motion to dismiss to be filed before an answer. That's specifically outlined in Rule 12 that said any of these defenses must be raised in a motion other than subject matter jurisdiction, I believe, which can be raised any time.
I mean, it doesn't say the first responsive pleading.
Right, which is an answer. A motion to dismiss isn't a responsive pleading. So the motion has to be raised. The first responsive pleading for the commissioner would be an answer. And so you'd have to, you can't answer and then file a motion to dismiss under the rules. In any event, I think that it's clear, what the statute outlines is that in 586.06, I believe, 586.08, I'm sorry, that the pleadings are construed and amended and the issues tried and further proceedings had in the same manner as in a civil action. And I think this court is well aware of how motions to dismiss work in civil actions, that we are able to file a motion to dismiss and then delay the time to answer. The final thing I'd just like to say in my last 30 seconds is the reliance on Jack and all of those cases is inapposite because what happened in the 1950s is that the rules of civil procedure were promulgated and the motion to dismiss superseded the demur. And so in the Cook case that we cite, the Supreme Court said you can demur to the writ like in civil actions. And so just like in civil actions, that demur has been replaced by a motion to dismiss. So there's no reason why the commissioner can't file a motion to dismiss in a writ of mandamus. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you both for your briefing, for your oral arguments. The case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. Thanks.